Thanks for listening to Outcast World. You lock your front door, don't you? You wouldn't go out and leave the front door open. Well, that's essentially what you're doing when you're not using a VPN. Right now, your data is being tracked, stored, and sold by loads of people. For a lot of people that are listening to this show, that is not just annoying, it can also be very risky. NordVPN fixes it. It's fast, it's reliable, it's number one for consumers, and it takes less time to set up than ordering a takeaway. Outcast World listeners can get NordVPN for under £3 a month. That is up to 75% off. Just go to outcastworld.net. The link's at the top. Turn it on. Forget about it. Make yourself safer online with the number one NordVPN for under £3 a month at outcastworld.net.
This episode, I spoke to podcaster and radio presenter Graham Smith. We met originally because I interviewed him on BBC Radio London, and I love his podcast. So we talk about a big breakup that he had. There is a trigger warning on this episode for drug abuse and death as well, because after the breakup, the person he'd been involved with did pass away. So it's a really interesting, open chat about everything that went on in Graham's life at that time.
Coming up.
And then one morning, I'm lying in bed with the guy I was seeing at the time on a Sunday morning. And we'd had a nice early night on the Saturday, which I was very proud of. I used to turn off my phone on a Saturday night and go, you did it. Well done, you. And I woke up, turned my phone on, and my friend Stephen, I had a few missed calls on my phone. He hadn't spoke to me since kind of the start of when Darren had moved back to London. And I'm like, why is he ringing me? And then I answered my phone at 8:45 in the morning in 2015. And Steve's like, hello, Graham, it's Steve. I'm like, yeah, why are you ringing me? Is everything okay? Yeah, it's about Darren. Are you with someone? Are you somewhere safe? He's like, yeah. He's like, he died yesterday afternoon at 3 o'clock. It was Darren's last night in London before he moved to Manchester with a friend of ours. And whatever's happened, he's gone to a party and he stopped breathing, and anyway, he's dead. It was tortuous because I missed him anyway, and I'd started sort of texting again and everything. But to lose him in such traumatic way, after I really loved him, you know, obviously, you never feel love sometimes like you do when you're young, do you? So I'd lost him in that way, and then before I could even make proper peace with him, he died. It's still an open wound, that death. The bit that makes it even more unusual is the person who rung me to say that Darren had died was a mutual friend of mine and Darren's, Steve, who's now my partner, that has been my fiancé since 2018.
Wow.
How long have I been doing this podcast now? November 2021, because we won Best New Podcast at the British Podcast Awards Gold in 2022. We'd only made 6 episodes. So it's what, 4-5 years? We've just published episode 130, so this is episode 131. Wow. In that period, the world has gone from lockdown and the fight for more freedoms for us as queer people and as people of colour. I'm not saying that as a person of colour, but that was a fight that we had on our hands in the beginning, the first Trump presidency. COVID, the lockdowns, the enduring nightmare of the second Trump presidency, which is ongoing. And I've managed to kind of avoid answering many questions myself pretty well so far. This week, things are different. I've always told myself that if I was going to turn the microphone on myself, I'd want someone who was very good to do the interview. And I'm doing that today. I'm bringing you a story I've not told publicly before. And I told it to one of the best storytellers out there, the brilliant comedian, actor and podcaster Samantha Baines, who I love. Yes, her, off of the BBC. She's on The One Show. She's on Radio London. She's had roles in The Crown and Call the Midwife. The deaf bisexual mum from London is the perfect person to get this story out of me, and she did just that in November 2023. The story at this point is that I am out of work in November 2023. I've moved from Manchester and my old job in the Northwest, and my husband, now husband, at the time he wasn't, it was my fiancé, Steve, we're living at his mum's in Bromley in southeast London. As we settle back into the changes we made into our lives back into London, this is before I started my current show. And I've been doing a lot of thinking about the journey in my life so far, and about the ups and of the downs, and this chat comes from that period. This is the story of not my first love, my second love, technically, but this is the story of one of my first loves. Someone I think about several times a day, and I will for the rest of my life, because some people leave a mark in you and it never goes. This is how I lost the man I'd been with for a decade. He was my fiancé. He was my first fiancé. And I lost him to a complex and traumatic drugs death. And this is also how I came close to ending it all, at a mental institution with a meth problem. This is Outcast World, this week, hosted by the brilliant Samantha Baines, and taken from her podcast, The Divorce Social.
I am joined by Graham Smith, podcaster and radio presenter. Welcome to The Divorce Social.
Thanks for having me. I feel honoured because I've never actually been divorced, but I feel like if I was straight, I would have been divorced 5 times easily.
Well, you're very welcome to be part of The Divorce Social gang. So why do you think that you would have been divorced 5 times if you were straight?
Because I have this, from about the age of 15, there's never been a period where I've not been in a relationship for more than like a month. So I was one of those people that went from one relationship to the other, a couple of them longer than others, some of them a few months at a time. But I always went straight in, everything, 100%, never kept a little bit of myself back. So I know that the way those relationships went, if I'd have been straight, I would have been, let's get married, you know, like one of them people that does it after about 6 weeks, and then had to kind of rapidly undo it as I found out about all of the other person's shit that they had going on that I didn't know about. So yeah, I feel like almost in some ways being gay kind of saved me from just a string of failed marriages. Instead, I had just a string of failed relationships.
But you can get married. What stopped you?
That's true, you know. Well, not all the way through my life. So I'm 40, and what you were able to get into a civil partnership from 2005 when I would have been 23. And it was something I would have done, but it was a money thing sometimes. And my family, apart from mum, dad, uncles and stuff, sort of at my age, my generation and my family, none of us have really got married. So it's never really been a thing. I'm actually engaged now. I have been since...
Congrats.
Thank you. Since 2018, we're taking our time. And again, that's sometimes like a money thing. But now, Steve, my other half, all of his siblings are now fully married, including his sister, who got married actually on Saturday, actually. That was really nice, to a girlfriend. So there's the pressure now coming from the other family, if you get what I mean. We're like, when's the marriage? So yeah, I know it's always been, gay people can get married, but I think you're less likely to get married if you are gay. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that's just my way of looking at it.
That's interesting. Why do you think you're less likely to get married if you're gay?
Probably societal expectations, isn't it? The same way, I know I can adopt children and all of that sort of stuff, but the expectation isn't really there on me. It was never really there on me. You would find someone, you would settle down, you would have children, you'd get married. Those sort of heteronormative expectations on me. So I didn't really feel any pressure to kind of do that until I got with Steve. And then after a few years, he was like, the marriage thing came up time and time again. So yeah, I think as I see it, most of my friends aren't married.
And is that most of your gay friends or queer friends aren't married, or are there some straight friends in there as well?
So I've got straight friends as well, but most of my queer friends aren't married, if I'm honest, yeah. And it was almost kind of because they probably don't have the mum in the background. It's usually a mum, isn't it? When you get married, you know, there's there's a lot less of that going on. I think that's why it's happened.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I think my mum was the one who was like, what's going on here? When are you getting married? And now, since I've been divorced, she's just like, well, she's done it once. It's fine now. She can just do whatever she likes.
Yeah, well, I think in some ways, do you think queer people are a bit luckier in that respect sometimes? Because they haven't got someone breathing down the neck, forcing them sometimes into making a decision like, I must marry.
I don't know, though, because I'm bisexual. Yeah. So I think my family is more comfortable when I'm with someone of the opposite sex.
Yeah.
To them, that's like, oh, okay, you can get married and have babies and do all those things that we imagined you would do. Mm-hmm. So I think when I'm with someone of the opposite sex, they would pressure me to get married, but I don't know if they would. I mean, I've never introduced a woman I've been dating to any of my family.
How would that go down if you did?
Not very well with most people. I think the outskirts of the family would be like, sure, fine, face to face, and then probably like talk about it.
Yeah.
When they get home. But yeah, I don't know. I think because I only came out after I got divorced.
Yeah, which is the last few years, isn't it?
Yeah, well, God, it feels like so long ago now. But yeah, still less, probably like 7 years, 6 years, seven. I can't even remember anymore. But yeah, so obviously I knew before and I was, you know, I spoke to my ex about it when we were married. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I hadn't sort of outwardly said to the world, I'm bisexual. So I think also it's quite a new thing for them and never something they've had to really see because my two long-term relationships, my marriage and now the person I'm having a baby with are both men. So that makes them feel comfortable.
Are there any other queer people in your family?
No.
No. Okay. So you're kind of a trailblazer and there's a lot of pressure I think falls on people when they're the kind of, oh, we have to learn and we're going to learn and how we interact with you. And a lot of stuff falls onto you. And as far as I've seen anyway.
Well, my best friend is a woman married to a woman. And I think, you know, a lot of my family have met her and met her partner and met her previous partners and sort of been fine with that because it's slightly removed from the family, I think. But I think a lot has fallen on my best friend as well to be like a trailblazer for we're okay. We're not going to make you snog someone of the same sex if you don't want to.
Like,
catching. I'm a normal human being as well as, you know, being in love with another woman. So, I think she's had to take quite a toll as well, especially around, you know, and I don't want to speak for her, but, you know, her family as well. So yeah, it is a lot of pressure. Do you feel that in your life and also in the industry, you know, having to be the, I'm gay, but I'm okay.
Yeah, that
don't
was
worry.
The- Yeah. Well, I've been in radio since I left school. I was one of them lucky people who kind of like, as soon as they were out of school, sixth form was in some fairly decent gigs and it was the early noughties, and I was always very conscious of being, certainly on airwise, on a lineup, on a radio station, being usually the only gay in the village. And within that came a lot of pressure to kind of like to represent and go, we're not all like the things that you think we are. And for me personally, that probably came within that a bit of trying a bit too hard to fit in. So yeah, I'm gay, but oh, I'm just like you guys, you know, and then then within that comes all of the, you'll have heard of internalized homophobia, internalized queerphobia. Within a lot of that kind of came out within that. So yeah, there was always in the industry in the beginning, I used to feel acutely like, yeah, I was, people were evaluating what gay people were like by how they liked me as a person. And I felt a bit of pressure from that, certainly. Although the idea that there's no queer people in the radio industry or the broadcasting industry is not true. Cause obviously there are. And certainly nowadays, there's so many openly queer people on the radio, but in the early noughties, it was certainly a bit of a point of difference. It was like, he's gay and he's a Scouser. So there were two kind of like things that kept me just a bit different from other people. And I was really conscious of the fact that I had to kind of really do my best to represent both of them communities as best I could. People pleasing a bit too much.
It's interesting, isn't it? Were you ever advised not to talk about being gay? Or do you think you were pushed like to represent your queer identity?
I was largely left to it. I think the only time I felt
I was told, oh, don't talk about that, was actually not that long ago. It was in about 2014 when I was, so I had a bit of a rocky period, and then I kind of went right to the bottom of the pile again. I had a spell in rehab, had a bit of a nervous breakdown, and I came off the back of that and I was right at the bottom of the pile. And I remember a boss I had when I was doing a breakfast show was like, well, don't be telling the audience that you're gay. And I was like, why? And, we don't know how that would go down in, and he's talking about these little villages. And I was like, well, give a shit. Like that's up for them to deal with. I'm okay with this. So yeah, there was there, but you know, a lot of the time, largely people just let me get on with what I wanted to do. I didn't feel any heavy pressure. And it just really sticks out in my mind when that guy said that, oh, don't be talking about that. I remember thinking, right, well, that's going to make me talk about it twice as much then.
Yeah. Cause then it's in your head. You're like, oh, I always, when I present on, the BBC, I feel like I always just try and sneak it in that I'm bisexual, just because I feel like there isn't maybe as much representation, and I'm also deaf, so I talk about that as well. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of more accepted at the moment, because then they're like, oh, we're discussing disability, great,
yeah,
good for us. Yeah, but I feel like no one's ever said to me, don't mention it, or do mention it. I was on a TV show actually once and they said, do mention it. We want you to say you're bisexual. Like that's one of the reasons we're getting you on.
How did that feel?
I didn't mention it because it felt so alien to shoehorn it into the conversation happening. It would literally be like, you know, oh, and then I went to the supermarket and I'm bisexual. But yeah, and no one's ever told me not to or to say it on the BBC, but I always feel like I'd try and sneak it in somewhere.
I would.
I probably have been a little bit like, I went to the supermarket and I'm bisexual.
For me, it's those anti-wokeness guidelines that you are perceived to have at the BBC. Don't answer that. You don't have to say anything. But because they would be in the back of my head, I would want to get it right up front all the time.
Also, I think that the rebel in me is like, oh, I want to say the thing that I don't want to say. It's like when you get for anyone who's not in radio, there's like certain words that you know, you're not meant to swear, and there's certain swear words that are worse than others, aren't there?
Yeah.
So when I got the list of what the worst ones were, and obviously we can swear on this podcast, so I can say the worst swear word you can say on the BBC is motherfucker.
Is that the worst?
Yeah, that's
I always thought it was in the top three, not even the C word.
No.
I always feel like the C word's next level.
That's what I thought, but apparently the worst is motherfucker because of the connotations around it.
Oh, I guess so. When you analyse motherfucker, I mean,
it's quite
an insult, isn't it? Yeah.
So obviously, as soon as I found that out, I was like desperate to say it.
On a Sunday afternoon on Radio London, I'd pay you to do it.
I didn't, thank God. Yeah. But it is in the back of your mind. So obviously we've talked about you in the industry, and what about you in relationships? When, you know, are you happy to talk about when you came out and when you started dating?
I came out when I was 15. Remember the TV show Queer as Folk?
Yeah.
It was during the first series of the TV show Queer as Folk. I remember, so I'd started doing hospital radio, right? And I made a friend there who was the same age as me. And we got on really well. And it was back in the days where you'd ring each other on the house phone. So I'd have to ring his mum's house, he'd have to ring mine. I remember we were having a discussion one evening, and I was like, I think I'm bisexual. And he was like, I think I am too. And I was like, wow. But I was also a bit annoyed because I was like, well, that's my thing. Why do you have to be bisexual as well? And that was a staging post to full queerness. You know, I was, well, actually, if you're bisexual, you are fully queer. But you know what I mean? To the full binary, I'm a gay man. In reality, I probably am slightly bisexual, but I identify as a gay man because I always have, and I feel comfortable in that identity. So that went on for a bit, and he would come to my house and stay over like friends do, sleep over. And we'd all sleep in the same bed, and mum and dad didn't know. And then this went on for quite a while. During my GCSEs, it was. There was one time I was revising with him. We were quite a good influence on each other. We would revise together. We were good kids. As one time we were lay on my bed the day before some exam, I can't remember what the exam was, and my mum was downstairs, or I wasn't sure where she was, but as far as we were concerned, she wasn't on the same floor as us. And we were just lay on the bed. We weren't doing anything. He just was sort of had his head on me somewhere reading, and my mum just burst into the room and went, Graham, have you got that? And then we both got up, and then she's like, oh, I'm just going out. I'll see you in a bit. And then she left, and he was like, oh, I better go. I'm like, ooh. And he went, and she come back later. And yeah, that's when mum came at me whilst I was revising with the, what was that earlier on? And I'm like, oh, nothing, nothing. Just leave me alone. What was it? And she was very persistent. She still is my mum. She's very persistent. And then, yeah, she was like, are you gay? Now, at this point, I wasn't ready to give myself a label or anything, but mum said it and she was insistent on an answer. And I was kind of forced into a position really to give her the night before an exam as well. And I was like, yeah, I am. And then in the period after that, so it was 1998, this. And the period after that, I went to Chris's mum went on holiday and we were looking after the dogs. They had a dog. And I just went and stayed at his for a few days because wasn't that mum and dad weren't supporting. It's just that their heads fell off. They had a 15-year-old boy in 1998. All they knew was AIDS, really. All of that. Yeah, I think they mourned and this is a common thing with parents, and I think they're a bit more awkward talking about it now because it was a lot of pressure on me, I now see, for mum and dad to effectively act a bit like old Graham died. And then I went back a week later and, you know, I was still ringing them and everything. I was just staying at my friend, and things were all right, actually. Chris was allowed to stay. They paid for Chris to come on holiday with us. Then I got Chris into the sixth form I was in because it was quite a good school. He used to go to quite a rough comp, but he was like a bit of a swat at the comp. And yeah, do you know what? They were really supportive after that. I kind of, beyond that point where they acted a bit like I'd died, I almost feel like my time in sixth form and the upper bits of school feels a little bit like have you seen the TV show Heartstopper?
Yeah.
It felt a bit like that. I felt like Charlie's the main character, the curly-haired kid. I felt a bit like him and Kit. That's Kit, isn't it? The other guy. It was a bit like Chris, my boyfriend. And we had a kind of idyllic sort of school relationship. Looking back, there was bits where, bit of trauma, I guess, where people found out and would give us a bit of shit. But at this point, I was so, I knew that what I was doing wasn't wrong and I felt secure enough to kind of push back against it. So, and you know, the school, to their credit, they were dealt with a bit of a difficult thing when I go and say, these guys are calling me a queer and pushing me on the stairs. We're still during Section 28. It's a strict Catholic school, St. Edward's College in West Derby in Liverpool.
So was that your first relationship?
Yeah, Chris was my first relationship. Yeah, yeah, we were together for 5 years until I was 19 or 20. Just through that period, it was as much as being in a relationship, it was also a good way, a safe way to explore the world around us without too much going wrong. And it worked, you know, it worked until I went to, I deferred a year. I was working in radio when I went to uni in Manchester to do history and politics, and Chris did management science or something. And the relationship lasted until that point. And then I was in Manchester and I was like, oh, but there's all this stuff. And Chris was a bit more swatty and I wanted my career. And then we went our separate ways. But I look back at it at a great introduction to intimacy with another man, a great first relationship, and also a good way to kind of explore sex and boundaries. And kind of, it was a good thing. I'm still friends with him as well. Yeah. And then I got straight off the back of that and went into another relationship, and that lasted 9 years. That was more chaotic.
It's interesting you say at that age, because I remember, and you considering you were bisexual, because I remember considering I was gay, but then I knew I still liked all the genders. Mm-hmm. So I was always really confused by that. And I remember a friend of mine who is straight, and we were like hugging on the sofa watching TV. And I remember my dad then asking me if I was a lesbian. Mm-hmm. And saying no, because I was like, well, I'm not, because I still like men. And I mean, non-binary people weren't as weren't allowed to be as open about themselves then, but you know. And I remember, it's just interesting you saying you thought you were bisexual first before gay, because I sort of ignored the bisexual and kept leaping to gay. And then leaping back to straight and being like, well, no, I can't be fully gay because I still like a bit of penis sometimes. And it took me a long time of jumping back and forth to be like, oh, there is this thing in the middle that I'm allowed to be.
It was invalidated, wasn't it, for a bit? Mum used to say, oh, you've got to be one or the other.
Yeah.
Be greedy. And I kind of, if it was now when I was coming out, I'd probably just say I was pansexual.
Mm.
But I feel like that's a kind of, if I was to go on my social media now and go, I'm pan everybody, it would just, for me, it would look like I was just attention seeking. But I'm probably pansexual, but labels kind of fit, don't they? My identity is as a gay man. So yeah, if only we had the array of options that are available now to young people, or if I had them in the late 90s, there might have been a bit of a different outcome to a lot of stuff, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. I think I definitely would have explored more at a younger age. I mean, that's not to mean I didn't explore, because obviously mm-hmm. I did, but it was more like, oh, it's just me and my friend snogging because, you know, we're just like drunk, not yeah. like maybe yeah. we're both interested in exploring this. You know, it's just like, yeah, we're just like doing it because guys will see it and it'll be cute, but we weren't really. We
were, you loved it, really.
Yeah. Interesting. So you had what sounds like this lovely first relationship.
Beautiful. Yeah. Yeah.
And then you went into the slightly more chaotic.
Yeah.
9-year one. So what happened at the end of that one?
Right. So there was a lot of moving about. I was working in Leeds on what was called the Galaxy Network. It was a network of dance music stations, and I really loved being there. He moved in with me in Leeds really quickly. He was in Liverpool at first. It was a mad thing that you kind of think I would never do now at that speed, but it was like 100 miles an hour straight. Let's move in. And then we moved to London. And then in London, a few things happened. I probably developed a bit of a drugs problem. I did, that kind of bubbled over in the background, and we grew more distant, experiment a lot with being open. And there are a lot of life lessons from that. I'm not saying it's wrong, because it's not. It's great to do that when there's trust, but the trust broke down. And then we moved. I ended up in not a great situation mentally. I was like, I need to go, because a few things happened. And I was like, I need to move back up north to be near my family. And I moved up to Preston in Lancashire, where I took a job doing a breakfast show on a radio station. And it was just really difficult, because I'd moved from London to Preston, and I felt really kind of like it was the bright lights, and all of a sudden, Preston, the people are lovely, but I don't know if you've ever driven into Preston town centre off the back of living in Vauxhall. It was different. Yeah. And we just sort of drifted, and I was really tired working on breakfast and stuff. And in the end, a lot of stuff that had happened whilst we were in London just bubbled to a head. And I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. The incident that ended the relationship was one where police ended up being called, domestic incident kind of thing. And after that, we were like, no more. But we had to kind of live in the same house as each other whilst I was working super awful hours. My drugs problem was getting rapidly worse. So I've no doubt that I was difficult. He was difficult. And he then moved back to London, and I remained stuck up north. So all my friends were in London, and he'd moved back and was back in the group of friends that I liked, where I was kind of feeling isolated up north. And I went down this just mad path of, once we'd split, of just like, casual sex with people, wanting to tick loads of stuff off and experimenting with meth and a drug called GBL and anything really like that. And yeah, that led me to get into another relationship almost straight off the back of it with someone who had a similar set of issues to me. And we were both sort of like trauma bonding, sort of drug issue bonding. He had loads of issues going on, and Darren was no longer talking to me. And my friends were kind of on Darren's side, because they'd seen him more, and you know what people are like, and they split sides. So it was really difficult, that. And so for the best part of 2 years, I didn't get to speak to a lot of my friendship group, and I ended up in just a downward spiral until my drugs problem got so bad. I was just using a drug to go to sleep, to continue through the day. And I ended up realizing that I was like, I'm going to end up dead. So I put myself into a rehab thing, not one of the fabulous ones where people go off to Antigua for 2 weeks, get a suntan. Now, this was in North Manchester. It was organised by the NHS, and I was on the bottom rung. I'd been doing good in work and stuff previous to that, and all of a sudden I was here with heroin addicts, people who had terrible issues, who I found out I got on really well with as well, which was a real eye-opener to me. And it kind of opened up a huge thing in my head that, like, these people like me, and I'm in this place, and I'm not on drugs, so you must like me. And it was kind of a really, from it being really dark, because when I arrived in that place, I attempted to take my own life, and because I felt I was so low. But when I left, I felt like there was a path. Wasn't plain sailing after that. Two other relationships happened. And then one morning, I'm lying in bed with the guy I was seeing at the time on a Sunday morning. And we'd had a nice early night on the Saturday, which I was very proud of. I used to turn off my phone on a Saturday night and go, oh, you did it. Well done, you. And I woke up, turned my phone on, and my friend Stephen, I had a few missed calls on my phone. He hadn't spoke to me since kind of the start of when Darren had moved back to London. And I was like, oh, why is he ringing me? And then I answered my phone at 8:45 in the morning in 2015. And Steve's like, hello, Graham, it's Steve. I'm like, yeah, why are you ringing me? Is everything okay? Yeah, it's about Darren. Are you with someone? Are you somewhere safe? I was like, yeah. He's like, he died yesterday afternoon at 3 o'clock. It was Darren's last night in London before he moved to Manchester with a friend of ours. And whatever's happened, he's gone to a party and he stopped breathing and anyway, he's dead. And I was just like, it was tortuous because I missed him anyway. And I'd started sort of texting again and everything. But to lose him in such a traumatic way, after I really loved him, you know, obviously it was, you never feel love sometimes like you do when you're young, do you? Because you can't contextualize them feelings. So I'd lost him in that way. And then before I could even make proper peace with him, he died. It's still an open wound, that death. The bit that makes it even more unusual is the person who rung me to say that Darren had died was a mutual friend of mine and Darren's, Steve, who's now my partner, that has been my fiance since 2018.
Wow.
So off the back of that, me and Steve, I guess, trauma bonded a bit, and some of our friends didn't approve of it, and we ended up in a relationship, and we both knew we could help each other emotionally and where we were up to, and got ourselves into a much better place. And now, yeah, me and Steve are going to get married, I believe, next year. We're planning to put a date in. So yeah, that kind of ties up some aspects of what had gone on when you asked about that relationship. It was, Darren always used to say to me, he was very funny. He was a charmer. He was very funny. And he used to say, if I die, I'm going to fucking haunt you. And he died. And I feel like he does haunt me for good and for bad. So yeah, that ties together a lot of things. And I've missed out relationships in there that really taught me things about, in that period when I wasn't in communication with my regular friendship group that I'd known since I'd been at that period at uni in Manchester, I got into a couple of relationships. One person who had terrible problems himself, and, you know, he would attack me, yeah, beat me up on several occasions, stole from me. And then someone else who did something similar. And there was like a pattern of just like people abusing me. And I've gone through therapy since. And what they've said is, why did you stick around and how did you keep yourself together? I was like, I don't know. And they went, I think that you kind of conditioned yourself to believe that that was what you deserved. That's all you deserve. So you go back to similar sort of people and repeat the kind of, and it was rinse and repeat really until Steve.
Wow. There's a lot in there.
A lot to unpack, isn't there?
Yeah. Oh my goodness. So there's so much to deal with. I think a lot of people will be able to relate, not necessarily to the exact circumstances, mm-hmm. but that idea of, you know, you're not in a good place at the end of a relationship and then you break up and you can spiral, you know, mm-hmm. of, whether that's casual sex. I mean, I had a lot of casual sex and I had a lovely time, but, you know, whether it is doing things that, you know, you look back on and think, I wasn't in a good place doing that. I didn't necessarily want to do that or was in control of myself when I was doing that. And then also, you know, everything in your life can spiral. For you, it was drugs that got, you know, even worse and developed. Because you said you went to rehab. How did you decide when you were in that downward spiral, enough is enough? Or was it a friend who said it to you? Or do you remember that turning point moment of, I have to do something now?
It became clear to me that if I continued on the reg doing what I was doing, even if it was every weekend, every other weekend, that at some point my luck would run out and I would die. I think it was just a sequence of different things that led me to that point, because there were a number of just crazy, if you end up in that world, the sort of, as gay men call it, the chemsex scene, if you end up in that, you can, a lot of things are normalized, where you'd be like, I've been away for 2 days, that's perfectly fine, I'm going to go to the shops now. Not normal. But for someone who's in that scene, just can pop to Tesco, you know, and then to a sex party or whatever. Now, my whole life wasn't like that, but it was in being around people who were unstable like that, you bump into characters that are kind of an example of what is going to happen to you if you don't sort yourself out. Yeah, there were a number of times when I drugged myself to sleep when, you know, I very nearly didn't wake up. So I would take what I was taking and then take a sleeping tablet on top of it, which is enough to knock you out where you'd never wake up. And I just became aware that, you know, running them odds continually, you're going to die. So I made that calculation myself, and I wanted to be, I love what I did for a living. And I think, you know, not a lot of people know the sequence of events that I've just told you there. And some people might be like, why did you go off the boil for quite a while? About 10 years. There's the answer. Because, you know, it's difficult to hold any semblance of a career together when the rest of your life is in complete chaos. The people that are meant to love you don't love you. And you're exposing yourself to danger quite regularly. And you're drained. So I just wanted my life to be better than where it was going. The point at which I had to go in and do that was at the point at which the Conservatives just got into power in 2010. So by about 2012, the cuts were really starting to bite. And the first thing they made cuts to was them services, those services that you sort of self-refer to a drug service. First thing to go. So I really fell down the cracks there, and it took me about 5 months to be able to get into the treatment, literally harassing the people that I really need this. And in the end, I was like, this isn't going to happen. I remember I must have spent a month just in the house. And in the end, the person who was like a social worker character came and put a letter, handwritten letter through my door and said, Graham, call me on this number. I've got you a place. We can get this fixed. And I'll never forget the relief that I got when that little note was pushed through my door, because I thought they were going to just leave me to rot. I thought, this is me written off, aged whatever I was, 29, 28. So yeah, it was a tough journey getting into there. And yeah, I just didn't want to die, you know. That was the main thing. And it was just such a shame that, it's such a shame in a lot of ways that Darren didn't make it as well. You know, I always feel, it always makes me feel quite sad that.
It's one of those sort of strange life parallels of, you know, you were obviously in a really bad place and then you asked for help. And also the fact that you had to ask for help so relentlessly before mm-hmm. you got it must have taken a lot of stamina. But then you got help and now you're okay. Whereas this other person that you'd been in love with, who maybe, I don't know, but it sounds like wasn't in a similar downward spiral to you, then wasn't okay. It's one of those horribly awful, ironic life things.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
And you said that Darren said he'd haunt you, and you think he does.
It makes me laugh though when thinking about it, because he fucking does.
But how do you think he haunts you? Do you think he's a reminder to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was a thing after someone close to you dies, you look for or something really unexpected like that happens, you start to look for answers everywhere. So I went to see several psychics. I've heard this on your podcast before. I was listening to one of your latest episodes, someone was talking about going to see a psychic, and you have to be careful with how much you take on board, I think, with what they say, because some mad people just say they're a psychic. But every time I went to see someone, he came up, and there was one woman in particular who described him and said he was in the corner of the room looking at me, and it was all okay. And I was like, how do you know? How did you know what he looked like? And it properly like befuddled me, because like, how did you know what he looked like? So I think in some respects he haunts me because you can never forget someone like that. And also for a period, I think it felt like he did literally haunt a few of us. But that's only because I think we were so grief stricken and susceptible to the concept of that. But, yeah, we'll never stop thinking about him and talk about him. You know, he does haunt my thoughts all the time. And not in always in a sad way. Like, when someone dies, you can just think of them as being, oh, they were saintly. And I think of him now, and I'm like, I think of him being funny, but he could also be an absolute cunt sometimes, you know? You can get that with people, oh, he was lovely. And I'm like, no, I remember sometimes he was an absolute shitbag. Well, so was I. So you can, it's complex, isn't it? How you remember someone after they've gone after a while, and there's been a lot of stuff has happened. But yeah, he does haunt me. He did get his wish.
Well, obviously it's not the same, but my dad died, and I remember I was looking for lots of signs that he was still around after he first died. And yeah, definitely had this, like, he was the best dad ever view. And now I think, like, nearly 7 years on, or over 7 years on, I can be like, no, he was a bit of a shit sometimes. Like, he was an annoying dad, but he was also great. And
yeah.
And I think for me, it's interesting because life events come up and then I think of him more, maybe because he's, you know, my dad, but obviously I'm having a baby now. So yeah. I'm about to become a parent and he's not around. Do you think for you, you know, you're about to get married to someone you met through Darren?
Yeah.
Do you think he comes up more for you at those times?
Yeah. 100%. I've had to go through a lot of thinking about all of that. And so I mean, I met Steve before Darren, and then he was, but yeah, we were all in the kind of same group of people. And I guess, yeah, I do. Yeah, not a day goes by where I don't think about him really. And I think about how lucky my journey's been in comparison to his as well. I always think, you know, you had a lot left in you. And I think that, yeah, when the wedding day comes, we will remember him, but I need to try and not allow that to be, it's managing that memory, isn't it? And doing it in a decent way. You know, I miss my nan. She died at the start of the year. I miss her terribly. I wanted her to see me get married, but she won't. So it's managing them things and not letting your happy day become, you know, I don't think anyone would really want that.
Yeah, my dad did actually die just before my wedding. So oh, wow. I put my wedding dress on and cried.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, I didn't manage it in a very good way. Yeah, it's interesting, this thing of these big events coming up, I think. And also, it's hard going through a breakup anyway. You were in a difficult place at that time. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, you know, may say when they get divorced, a lot of people don't, but some people say it would be better if they were dead because I wouldn't be able to see them anymore, whereas they're still in my life. Well, yeah. You know, I'm not saying that that's the right thing to say, but, you know, when you're in the difficult bit of it, but what's it like having broken up with someone and then they died during sort of still that breakup period?
It is the most complex of grief. It's difficult to describe the grief there. What is always weird to me is that moonpig.com every year sends me absolutely under round about the start of October. Goes, have you sent Darren his card yet? Darren's card needs to be sent. And I get reminded of it every year. And social media is what kind of immortalizes people. So we stopped following each other on Facebook, as was customary at the time. If you remember, I'm unfollowing on Facebook, but all our friends and our mums and families were all still, but we didn't follow each other. So for me, it's always a bit like, he used to come up, who's like to follow Darren? And I'm like, and this picture of him, I often go to his Facebook profile, and people do this after someone's passed away, don't they? And look at it, and he's there 2 days before drinking a champagne with his friend, this smile. And yeah, I find that that he haunts me there as well, if I'm honest with you. It is a really complex, bittersweet grief, that. So my nan dying, I don't have any real trauma associated with that, because the night before she died, I could tell she was fading. She was about to get put to bed. And mum said, she's tired here. Do you want to speak to her? And I went, hello, Nana. Are you okay? Nice to speak to you. Okay. Well, you have a nice night's sleep. You sleep well, Nana. Good night. I love you. Great. Put to bed. It makes me feel warm inside. Falling out with someone, unfollowing them, feeling a load of anger, blah, 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 and then just about putting the pieces back together and then dead. Is quite hard for a person to kind of put into a sort of a narrative that doesn't traumatize you, you know?
How do you deal with that? Because, you know, I broke up with my ex in quite an amicable way initially, and then things weren't very amicable during the divorce. And then we didn't speak to each other. And then, you know, we've sent a few texts, and like, I let him know when I was pregnant before I put it everywhere. Mm-hmm. And so this feels like quite a nice sort of point of closure of like, oh, we can have those texts and everything's fine. But you obviously, like you said, didn't get to that final point. So how have you or are you dealing with that or not?
Yeah. Well, for a period, probably not. Now I look back at where my behavior went around then. I was like, I'm fine. And then demonstrated in fine style how unfine I was not at the time. By dipping back into a few of them old habits. But because the stabilizers were on, there was accountability. I had to turn up to work, all of that. It was difficult to fall completely off the wagon. But there were moments when people were like, shit, what is going on with him? Accountability, critical. And actually therapy in the end, because when me and Steve had a relationship, he was in London and I was in Liverpool working for Capital Radio up there in my home city. And I'd see him over a weekend, and that's very different to living with someone when he deals with you. When you've come home from work, you've done a live show every day, you're a bit drained after doing them things, especially where a lot lands on you, aren't you? And I'd just be in a bad mood. angry on my journey home. So what I began to see was that I'm not a violent person, but I need to make that clear. Just I was aggy and angry and just in a bad mood after work and easily irritable. And I was wondering why am I like this? So I started going to some therapy, and it's clear that them things that went on and his death was coming out of me in weird ways. Sometimes I'm one of them people that, like, you know, someone could be shot in front of me and I'd be like, oh, I'd do what I could to help. And I wouldn't be happy to see it, but also it wouldn't have bothered me. And then actually what happens to me personally is I think I process things quite slowly in the background. 3 months later, oh, my behavior changes a bit. 12 months later, I'm just really fucked off all the time. And I don't know why, because have you ever heard of the idea of racket emotions in therapy? The idea that you have your regular emotion that you're used to having and your go-to. Or one that was kind of, as a kid, was kind of like displayed and valorized. So for me, it was anger. Men should be angry. So if I was feeling hurt or upset, I couldn't allow that to come to the surface. So you have your initial reaction, which is anger. And that's therapy pointed that out to me. So it's like, what's actually going on underneath? So yeah, therapy for 2 and a bit years until, you know, it always makes me laugh when someone says, yeah, I did therapy. I had 6 sessions. And I'm like, right, did you? You had 6 Zoom chats. 2 years worth. And, you know, there's still more work to be done. It's an ongoing thing, I think. I'm only just at the stage now where I really particularly, I'm really up for like having a conversation about it. I don't mind dipping into it and revisiting it now. You know, it doesn't tear me apart.
I think that's a healthy thing as well. I think when something first happens to you, or when something first happens to me, I want to talk about it all the time and everyone gets sick of it because I'm kind of trying to process it by saying it out loud.
Yeah.
And then I don't talk about it for a really long time when I actually process it. And then I can come back to it sort of years later, like now, and then talk about it possibly with much more perspective and also accountability of my part in the situation when it comes to a breakup and things. But yeah, therapy, I'm a big fan of therapy. I've had a lot of therapy, and I can totally relate to what you said about anger. And in fact, therapists have said to me, usually it's more of a male trait because men are brought up to believe that they shouldn't cry.
Yeah.
Whereas women are normally brought up to believe they shouldn't be angry.
Yeah.
So we cry when we feel angry. So it's the opposite, but I don't, for whatever reason. So my natural reaction is always anger. And it's normally that I want to cry, but I feel that I need to put the protection up. So I do anger instead. And it's still an ongoing thing, you know, in my relationship now, it's still an ongoing thing of I have to remind myself, what are you actually angry about? Are you angry?
Yeah.
Or are you hurt and feeling vulnerable?
That's it, yeah.
And anger is like your go-to.
You feel powerful when you're angry, though. I'd say this. Anger is it could be such a good, not good things, it's unhealthy, but like it can be such an empowering thing to lean on. I'm not a victim. I'm angry. I'm fucked off. And that feels so much more comfortable than actually accepting that you're really upset, doesn't it? Because then you feel vulnerable. So if things aren't great, sometimes anger can cut. I just found it helped me plow through stuff. But it only gets you so far, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think anger can be useful, like plowing through. You know, and nowadays I help to fight like disability discrimination and things like that. And so anger, sort of a low level, does help me in those situations of like, no, I'm not going to put up with this. But then, yeah, if it's covering something else, then that's when you need to do the work.
Or if it's impacting your current relationships as well, that they're dealing with stuff that's not on them. This is from ages ago, other people's shit. And at that point, it kind of, for me, I didn't want to be annoyed at Steve for stuff that he hadn't even done. I thought, that's not fair.
It's like when you have a dream. This is normally said to be a woman thing, but I think it can happen with all of us. Or those people who vividly dream, I think, is you have a dream that your partner has done something and then you wake up and you're still annoyed with them for the thing they did in the dream. And they're like, I didn't do it though. So can you just be nice to me? But I think that's a really good point that you made about not being angry with your current partner and not letting things affect your current partner from the past. And I think a lot of people will be able to relate to that. And obviously your situation is slightly more involved because your partner knew your ex-partner.
Yeah.
How do you, and how have you in your relationship, left some of those things behind and tried to kind of marker out your new relationship and let that be what it is.
We are in that place. There was a period where I thought we wouldn't be. Like when we got together, no one wanted us to be together. My dad was like, he lives where? And I was like, London? And he goes, oh, fucking hell. Well, no. And I was like, well, why are you getting involved? Didn't want it. And one of my best friends was like, I think that, you know, if you are going to commit to this, you're carrying a literal bin lorry full of shit behind you and you're going to have to go and delve into that shit. And that's quite the job. And he went, and you're not living together. It's going to be tough. I didn't want to hear any of it. So by doing literally what my friend Joe said, which was going through the shit, unfortunately, and sometimes it's inconvenient. It's good to do it in a structured way. We were on holiday in, we went to Sitges, and I remember one evening, and it was actually cathartic for me and for him. There was a learning process about how hurt I felt when Darren kind of moved down back down to London, and I had all my friends on side, and I sat on this. This is going to sound way more dramatic than it was, but it was like a cliff edge. There was, don't worry, there's nothing mad about to happen, but we were sat there looking out to sea, and I was crying, and I was telling him, I was like, listen, I felt like this, and I need you to know this. And he heard every word I said, and he understood because he'd had experiences like that in the past. And that was just one example of going through the stuff, getting the initial thing out the way, which is always painful, and you have to go through it all, because I don't know if you're anything like me, I don't forget anything. Everything's stored up there. Doesn't matter how small it is, the slightest slight, I will remember unless I kind of readdress it in my head. So the best way to do that, I think, is you're going to have to face up to it all and go through it and get it off your chest and let them get it off their chest and maybe have a bit of an argument. But then I find just being heard is cathartic when the person that you feel like, you need to hear this, once they've heard it and they've took it on board, that's cathartic. And if you can't find someone who's going to listen to you and hear you, then I don't think that you're with the right person.
And if you can do that outing process whilst you're in front of a nice view, then mm-hmm. even better. Film so it.
I wouldn't recommend a cliff edge.
Yeah, maybe
like
not.
We did. Maybe so it was beautifully scenic, but you know, too many things can go wrong there.
Maybe on the beach.
On the beach would be nice in the
flat
day.
Ground. And obviously now you're engaged and you're planning a wedding. Congrats. How do you view marriage, because obviously you haven't been married before, but as you said, you feel like you could have been divorced five times. Yeah. How do you view marriage and the idea that marriage doesn't always last?
Yeah, I view like we all change, don't we? Like I'm a different person now to the person I discussed had all them issues. On a cellular level, we're always regenerating. Speak to trans people, they say, you know, oh, change is something that happens in all of us. You know, so you have to accept that you're not the person that you once were. In terms of marriage, I always think it's the kind of thing that other people do and I don't. And the idea of the formalities of it, like the parents doing speeches, well, let me tell you, as queer people, sometimes we're allowed to reinvent the way these things work.
Yeah.
And I've just seen a family marriage work the other day, you know, the family being involved. And I know there's formalities and things that are expected. And for me, I'm always like, I'm almost more comfortable as a spectator in that kind of thing than it all being about me. So marriage is a thing that, and I also expect, you know, by the time we're 50, maybe we'll hate each other. I hope not. But I think that the only way we can not end up feeling like that is to continually work on things and to take them learnings that I've taken from therapy and getting the things out there and going through it all. Keep doing that and also keep having sex. I think like is a critical thing because, you know, it doesn't matter how much Steve annoys me. As long as we're having sex, it's somehow magically it's all forgiven. It's somehow. And I think if you can combine them things together and have open conversations about what you want across everything, why would you want to end the marriage? Thoroughly aware that was it like 50% of marriages don't work. But I feel like I'm ready at this stage now, 40, to be in a relationship that has sort of foundations that sort of like, you know, if we have a fallout, we can't just go, oh, fuck you, walk out and stay wherever. It's like we're kind of put together somehow. And I feel like we've gone through enough stuff that this won't be the hardest thing that we've done. I hope anyway.
So I think that sounds a very healthy way to approach marriage, coming from a divorced lady who hears about divorces all the time. So I hope you won't be back on the podcast to talk about divorce.
Fingers crossed.
But also, I do like talking to you. So if that does happen, you're very welcome. How has the divorce social experience been for you?
Incredible. It's been cathartic. It's been like those therapy sessions I talked about. It's been a bit like them. The same setup on Zoom, you know, a lot of similarities.
I'll bill you for £120.
Okay. Yeah, well, I wasn't paying £120 for therapy sessions.
I know, but some are so expensive. I wasn't paying that either, but...
Not in Liverpool.
Okay.
They were like half the price. Yeah, fingers crossed they don't come back on with an awful divorce story, but absolutely open to coming back on.
Thank you.
Stay with me. This is incredibly simple. If you've ever used Grindr, Googled something rather personal, or posted anything political, your data is already being tracked and sold. Think about that. A VPN can make you a lot safer. NordVPN takes about 2 minutes to set up, one click to turn on, and it just runs in the background. There's no effort after that. It's consistently voted number one across a load of metrics for consumers. It's fast, it's secure, and there's no drop-offs. Outcast World listeners can get up to 75% off NordVPN right now, which brings it down to under £3 a month. Go to outcastworld.net. Top of the page, tap the link, then you're done. Outcastworld.net for up to 75% off NordVPN.